Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $300 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $300 into something bigger when you bet on money lines, spread, totals, player props.
$300 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365.
Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In-app only.
Book the Last, Chapter 3, Part 2 of Armadale. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Julie Bynum. Armadale by Wilkie Collins. Chapter 3, Part 2. I might introduce you to all sorts of other contrivances of the same kind, he resumed, leading the way downstairs, but it would only be the same thing over and over again. A nervous patient who always has his own way is a nervous patient who is never worried, and a nervous patient who is never worried is a nervous patient cured. There it is in a nutshell. Come and see the dispensary, ladies. The dispensary and the kitchen next. Once more, Miss Gwilt dropped behind the visitors and waited alone, looking steadfastly at the room which the doctor had opened and at the apparatus which the doctor had unlocked. Again, without a word passing between them, she had understood him. She knew as well as if he had confessed it that he was craftily putting the necessary temptation in her way before witnesses who could speak to the superficially innocent acts which they had seen if anything serious happened. The apparatus, originally constructed to serve the purpose of the doctor's medical crochets, was evidently to be put to some other use, of which the doctor himself had probably never dreamed till now, and the chances were that before the day was over that other use would be privately revealed to her at the right moment, in the presence of the right witness. "Armadale will die this time," she said to herself as she went slowly down the stairs. "The doctor will kill him by my hands." The visitors were in the dispensary when she joined them. All the ladies were admiring the beauty of the antique cabinet, and as a necessary consequence, all the ladies were desirous of seeing what was inside. The doctor, after a preliminary look at Miss Gwilt, good-humoredly shook his head. "There is nothing to interest you inside," he said, "nothing but rows of little shabby bottles containing the poisons used in medicine which I keep under lock and key. Come to the kitchen, ladies, and honor me with your advice on domestic matters below stairs." He glanced again at Miss Gwilt as the company crossed the hall with a look which said plainly, "Wait here." In another quarter of an hour the doctor had expounded his views on cookery and diet, and the visitors, duly furnished with prospectuses, were taking leave of him at the door. "Quite an intellectual treat," they said to each other as they streamed out again in neatly dressed procession through the iron gates. "And what a very superior man!" The doctor turned back to the dispensary, humming absently to himself, and failing entirely to observe the corner of the hall in which Miss Gwilt stood retired. After an instant's hesitation, she followed him. The assistant was in the room when she entered it, summoned by his employer the moment before. "Doctor," she said coldly and mechanically, as if she was repeating a lesson, "I am as curious as the other ladies about that pretty cabinet of yours. Now they are all gone, won't you show the inside of it to me?" The doctor laughed in his pleasantest manner. "The old story," he said, "Bluebeard's locked chamber and female curiosity. Don't go, Benjamin, don't go." "My dear lady, what interest can you possibly have in looking at a medical bottle, simply because it happens to be a bottle of poison?" She repeated her lesson for the second time. "I have the interest of looking at it," she said, "and of thinking, if it got into some people's hands, of the terrible things it might do." The doctor glanced at his assistant with a compassionate smile. "Curious, Benjamin," he said, "the romantic view taken of these drugs of ours by the unscientific mind. My dear lady," he added, turning to Miss Gwilt, "if that is the interest you attach to looking at poisons, you needn't ask me to unlock my cabinet. You need only look about you round the shelves of this room. There are all sorts of medical liquids and substances in those bottles, most innocent, most useful in themselves, which in combination with other substances and other liquids become poisons as terrible and as deadly as any I have in my cabinet under lock and key." She looked at him for a moment and crossed to the opposite side of the room. "Show me one," she said. Still smiling as good-humoredly as ever, the doctor humored his nervous patient. He pointed to the bottle from which he had privately removed the yellow liquid on the previous day, and which he had filled up again with a carefully colored imitation in the shape of a mixture of his own. "Do you see that bottle?" he said. "That plump, round, comfortable-looking bottle? Never mind the name of what is beside it. Let us stick to the bottle, and distinguish it, if you like, by giving it a name of our own. Suppose we call it our stout friend." "Very good. Our stout friend, by himself, is a most harmless and useful medicine. He is freely dispensed every day to tens of thousands of patients all over the civilized world. He has made no romantic appearances in courts of law. He has excited no breathless interest in novels. He has played no terrifying part on the stage. There he is, an innocent, inoffensive creature who troubles nobody with the responsibility of locking him up. But bring him into contact with something else, introduce him to the acquaintance of a certain common mineral substance of a universally accessible kind broken into fragments, provide yourself with, say, 6 doses of our stout friend, and pour those doses consecutively on the fragments I have mentioned at intervals of not less than 5 minutes. Quantities of little bubbles will rise at every pouring. Collect the gas in those bubbles and convey it into a closed chamber, and let Samson himself be in that closed chamber. Our stout friend will kill him in half an hour. Will kill him slowly, without his seeing anything, without his smelling anything, without his feeling anything but sleepiness. Will kill him, and tell the whole college of surgeons nothing if they examine him after death, but that he died of apoplexy or congestion of the lungs. What do you think of that, my dear lady, in the way of mystery and romance? Is our harmless stout friend as interesting now as if he rejoiced in the terrible popular fame of the arsenic and the strychnine which I keep locked up there? Don't suppose I am exaggerating. Don't suppose I'm inventing a story to put you off with, as the children say. Ask Benjamin there," said the doctor, appealing to his assistant, with his eyes fixed on Miss Gwilt. "Ask Benjamin," he repeated, with the steadiest emphasis on the next words, "if 6 doses from that bottle, at intervals of 5 minutes each, would not, under the conditions I have stated, produce the results I have described." The resident dispenser, modestly admiring Miss Gwilt at a distance, started and colored up. He was plainly gratified by the little attention which had included him in the conversation. "The doctor is quite right, ma'am," he said, addressing Miss Gwilt with his best bow. "The production of the gas, extended over half an hour, would be quite gradual enough. And," added the dispenser, silently appealing to his employer to let him exhibit a little chemical knowledge on his own account, "the volume of the gas would be sufficient at the end of the time, if I am not mistaken, sir, to be fatal to any person entering the room in less than 5 minutes." "Unquestionably, Benjamin," rejoined the doctor. "But I think we have had enough of chemistry for the present," he added, turning to Miss Gwilt. "With every desire, my dear lady, to gratify every passing wish you may form, I venture to propose trying a more cheerful subject. Suppose we leave the dispensary before it suggests any more inquiries to that active mind of yours. No? You want to see an experiment? You want to see how the little bubbles are made? Well, well, there is no harm in that." "We will let Mrs. Armadale see the bubbles," continued the doctor, in the tone of a parent humoring a spoiled child. "Try, if you can, find a few of those fragments we want, Benjamin. I dare say the workmen, slovenly fellows, have left something of the sort about the house or the grounds." The resident dispenser left the room. As soon as his back was turned, the doctor began opening and shutting drawers in various parts of the dispensary, with the air of a man who wants something in a hurry and does not know where to find it. "Bless my soul!" he exclaimed, suddenly stopping at the drawer from which he had taken his cards of invitation on the previous day. "What's this? A key? A duplicate key, as I'm alive, of my fumigating apparatus upstairs. Oh, dear, dear, how careless I get," said the doctor, turning round briskly to Miss Gwilt. "I hadn't the least idea that I possessed this second key. I should never have missed it. I do assure you I should never have missed it if anybody had taken it out of the drawer." He bustled away to the other end of the room, without closing the drawer and without taking away the duplicate key. In silence, Miss Gwilt listened till he had done. In silence, she glided to the drawer. In silence, she took the key and hid it in her apron pocket. The dispenser came back with the fragments required of him, collected in a basin. "Thank you, Benjamin," said the doctor. "Kindly cover them with water while I get the bottle down." As accidents sometimes happen in the most perfectly regulated families, so clumsiness sometimes possesses itself of the most perfectly disciplined hands. In the process of its transfer from the shelf to the doctor, the bottle slipped and fell smashed to pieces on the floor. "Oh, my fingers and thumbs!" cried the doctor, with an air of comic vexation. "What in the world do you mean by playing me such a wicked trick as that? Well, 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 it can't be helped. Have we got any more of it, Benjamin?"
"Not a drop, sir."
"Not a drop," echoed the doctor. "My dear madam, what excuses can I offer you? My clumsiness has made our little experiment impossible for today. Remind me to order some more tomorrow, Benjamin, and don't think of troubling yourself to put that mess to rights. I'll send the man here to mop it all up." "Our stout friend is harmless enough now, my dear lady, in combination with a boarded floor and a coming mop. I'm so sorry. I really am so sorry to have disappointed you." With those soothing words, he offered his arm and led Miss Gwilt out of the dispensary. "Have you done with me for the present?" she asked when they were in the hall. "Oh, dear, dear, what a way of putting it!" exclaimed the doctor. "Dinner at 6, he added with his politest emphasis, as she turned from him in disdainful silence and slowly mounted the stairs to her own room. A clock of the noiseless sort, incapable of offending irritable nerves, was fixed in the wall above the first-floor landing at the sanitarium. At the moment when the hands pointed to 6:15, the silence of the lonely upper regions was softly broken by the rustling of Miss Gwilt's dress. She advanced along the corridor of the first floor, paused at the covered apparatus fixed outside the room numbered 4, listened for a moment, and then unlocked the cover with the duplicate key. The open lid cast a shadow over the inside of the casing. All she saw at first was what she had seen already, the jar and the pipe and glass funnel inserted in the cork. She removed the funnel, and looking about her, observed on the windowsill close by a wax-tipped wand used for lighting the gas. She took the wand, and introducing it through the aperture occupied by the funnel, moved it to and fro in the jar. The faint splash of some liquid and the grating noise of certain hard substances which she was stirring about were the two sounds that caught her ear. She drew out the wand and cautiously touched the wet left on it with the tip of her tongue. Caution was quite needless in this case. The liquid was water. In putting the funnel back in its place, she noticed something faintly shining in the obscurely lit vacant space at the side of the jar. She drew it out and produced a purple flask. The liquid with which it was filled showed dark through the transparent coloring of the glass, and fastened at regular intervals down one side of the flask were 6 thin strips of paper which divided the contents into 6 equal parts. There was no doubt now that the apparatus had been secretly prepared for her, the apparatus of which she alone, besides the doctor, possessed the key. She put back the flask and locked the cover of the casing. For a moment she stood looking at it with the key in her hand. On a sudden her lost color came back. On a sudden its natural animation returned for the first time that day to her face. She turned and hurried breathlessly upstairs to her room on the second floor. With eager hands she snatched her cloak out of the wardrobe and took her bonnet from the box. "I'm not in prison," she burst out impetuously. "I've got the use of my limbs. I can go, no matter where, as long as I am out of this house." With her cloak on her shoulders and her bonnet in her hand, she crossed the room to the door. A moment more, and she would have been out in the passage. In that moment the remembrance flashed back on her of the husband whom she had denied to his face. She stopped instantly, and threw the cloak and bonnet from her on the bed. "No," she said, "the gulf is dug between us. The worst is done." There was a knock at the door. The doctor's voice outside politely reminded her that it was 6 o'clock. She opened the door and stopped him on his way downstairs. "What time is the train due tonight?" she asked in a whisper. "At 10," answered the doctor in a voice which all the world might hear and welcome. "What room is Mr. Armadale to have when he comes?"
"What room would you like him to have?"
"Number 4." The doctor kept up appearances to the very last. "Number 4 let it be," he said graciously.
provided, of course, that number 4 is unoccupied at the time. The evening wore on, and the night came. At a few minutes before 10, Mr. Bashwood was again at his post, once more on the watch for the coming of the tidal train. The inspector on duty, who knew him by sight, and who had personally ascertained that his regular attendance at the terminus implied no designs on the purses and portmanteaus of the passengers, noticed two new circumstances in connection with Mr. Bashwood that night. In the first place, instead of exhibiting his customary cheerfulness, he looked anxious and depressed. In the second place, while he was watching for the train, he was, to all appearance, being watched in his turn by a slim, dark, undersized man who had left his luggage, marked with the name of Midwinter, at the custom-house department the evening before, and who had returned to have it examined about half an hour since. What had brought Midwinter to the terminus? And why was he, too, waiting for the tidal train? After straying as far as Hendon during his lonely walk of the previous night, he had taken refuge at the village inn, and had fallen asleep from sheer exhaustion towards those later hours of the morning which were the hours that his wife's foresight had turned to account. When he returned to the lodging, the landlady could only inform him that her tenant had settled everything with her and had left, for what destination neither she nor her servant could tell, more than 2 hours since. Having given some little time to inquiries, the result of which convinced him that the clue was lost so far, Midwinter had quitted the house and had pursued his way mechanically to the busier and more central parts of the metropolis. With the light now thrown on his wife's character, to call at the address she had given him as the address at which her mother lived would be plainly useless. He went on through the streets, resolute to discover her, and trying vainly to see the means to his end, till the sense of fatigue forced itself on him once more. Stopping to rest and recruit his strength at the first hotel he came to, a chance dispute between the waiter and a stranger about a lost portmanteau reminded him of his own luggage left at the terminus, and instantly took his mind back to the circumstances under which he and Mr. Bashwood had met. In a moment more, the idea that he had been vainly seeking on his way through the streets flashed on him. In a moment more, he had determined to try the chance of finding the steward again on the watch for the person whose arrival he had evidently expected by the previous evening's train. Ignorant of the report of Allan's death at sea, uninformed at the terrible interview with his wife of the purpose which her assumption of a widow's dress really had in view, Midwinter's first vague suspicions of her fidelity had now inevitably developed into the conviction that she was false. He could place but one interpretation on her open disavowal of him, and on her taking the name under which he had secretly married her. Her conduct forced the conclusion on him that she was engaged in some infamous intrigue, and that she had basely secured herself beforehand in the position of all others in which she knew it would be the most odious and most repellent to him to claim his authority over her. With that conviction, he was now watching Mr. Bashwood. Firmly persuaded that his wife's hiding-place was known to the vile servant of his wife's vices, and darkly suspecting as the time wore on that the unknown man who had wronged him and the unknown traveller for whose arrival the steward was waiting were one and the same. The train was late that night, and the carriages were more than usually crowded when they arrived at last. Midwinter became involved in the confusion on the platform, and in the effort to extricate himself he lost sight of Mr. Bashwood for the first time. A lapse of some few minutes had passed before he again discovered the steward talking eagerly to a man in a loose shaggy coat whose back was turned toward him. Forgetful of all the cautions and restraints which he had imposed on himself before the train appeared, Midwinter instantly advanced on them. Mr. Bashwood saw his threatening face as he came on, and fell back in silence. The man in the loose coat turned to look where the steward was looking, and disclosed to Midwinter, in the full light of the station lamp, Allan's face. For the moment they both stood speechless, hand in hand, looking at each other. Allan was the first to recover himself. "Thank God for this," he said fervently. "I don't ask how you came here. It's enough for me that you have come. Miserable news has met me already, Midwinter. Nobody but you can comfort me and help me to bear it."
His voice faltered over those last words, and he said no more. The tone in which he had spoken roused Midwinter to meet the circumstances as they were, by appealing to the old grateful interest in his friend which had once been the foremost interest of his life. He mastered his personal misery for the first time since it had fallen on him, and gently taking Allan aside, asked what had happened. The answer, after informing him of his friend's reported death at sea, announced on Mr. Bashwood's authority that the news had reached Miss Milroy, and that the deplorable result of the shock thus inflicted had obliged the Major to place his daughter in the neighborhood of London under medical care. Before saying a word on his side, Midwinter looked distrustfully behind him. Mr. Bashwood had followed them. Mr. Bashwood was waiting to see what they did next. "Was he waiting your arrival here to tell you this about Miss Milroy?" asked Midwinter, looking again from the steward to Allan. "Yes," said Allan. "He has been kindly waiting here night after night to meet me and break the news to me." Midwinter paused once more. The attempt to reconcile the conclusion he had drawn from his wife's conduct with the discovery that Allan was the man for whose arrival Mr. Bashwood had been waiting was hopeless. The one present chance of discovering a truer solution of the mystery was to press the steward on the one available point in which he had laid himself open to attack. He had positively denied on the previous evening that he knew anything of Allan's movements, or that he had any interest in Allan's return to England. Having detected Mr. Bashwood in one lie told to himself, Midwinter instantly suspected him of telling another to Allan. He seized the opportunity of sifting the statement about Miss Milroy on the spot. "How have you become acquainted with this sad news?" he inquired, suddenly turning on Mr. Bashwood. "Through the Major, of course," said Allan, before the steward could answer. "Who is the doctor who has the care of Miss Milroy?" persisted Midwinter, still addressing Mr. Bashwood. For the second time the steward made no reply. For the second time Allan answered for him. "He is a man with a foreign name," said Allan. "He keeps a sanitarium near Hampstead. What did you say the name of the place was called, Mr. Bashwood?" "Fairweather Vale, sir," said the steward, answering his employer as a matter of necessity, but answering very unwillingly. The address of the sanitarium instantly reminded Midwinter that he had traced his wife to Fairweather Vale Villas the previous night. He began to see light through the darkness, dimly, for the first time. The instinct which comes with emergency, before the slower process of reason can assert itself, brought him at a leap to the conclusion that Mr. Bashwood, who had been certainly acting under his wife's influence the previous day, might be acting again under his wife's influence now. He persisted in sifting the steward's statement, with the conviction growing firmer and firmer in his mind that the statement was a lie, and that his wife was concerned in it. "Is the Major in Norfolk?" he asked, "or is he near his daughter in London?" "In Norfolk," said Mr. Bashwood. Having answered Allan's look of inquiry, instead of Midwinter's spoken question in those words, he hesitated, looked Midwinter in the face for the first time, and added suddenly, "I object, if you please, to be cross-examined, sir. I know what I have told Mr. Armadale, and I know no more." The words and the voice in which they were spoken were alike at variance with Mr. Bashwood's usual language and Mr. Bashwood's usual tone. There was a sullen depression in his face. There was a furtive distrust and dislike in his eyes when they looked at Midwinter, which Midwinter himself now noticed for the first time. Before he could answer the steward's extraordinary outbreak, Allan interfered. "Don't think me impatient," he said, "but it's getting late. It's a long way to Hampstead. I'm afraid the sanitarium will be shut up." Midwinter started. "You're not going to the sanitarium tonight?" he exclaimed. Allan took his friend's hand and wrung it hard. "If you were as fond of her as I am," he whispered, "you would take no rest. You could get no sleep till you had seen the doctor and heard the best and the worst he had to tell you. Poor dear little soul! Who knows if she could only see me alive and well?" The tears came into his eyes, and he turned away his head in silence. Midwinter looked at the steward. "Stand back," he said. "I want to speak to Mr. Armadale." There was something in his eye which it was not safe to trifle with. Mr. Bashwood drew back out of hearing, but not out of sight. Midwinter laid his hand fondly on his friend's shoulder. "Allan," he said, "I have reasons..." He stopped. Could the reasons be given before he had fairly realized them himself, at that time too, and under those circumstances? Impossible. "I have reasons," he resumed, "for advising you not to believe too readily what Mr. Bashwood may say. Don't tell him this, but take the warning." Allan looked at his friend in astonishment. "It was you who always liked Mr. Bashwood," he exclaimed. "It was you who trusted him when he first came to the great house." "Perhaps I was wrong, Allan, and perhaps you were right. Will you only wait till we can telegraph to Major Milroy and get his answer? Will you only wait over the night?" "I shall go mad if I wait over the night," said Allan. "You have made me more anxious than I was before. If I am not to speak about it to Bashwood, I must and will go to the sanitarium and find out whether she is or is not there from the doctor himself." Midwinter saw that it was useless. In Allan's interest, there was only one other course left to take. "Will you let me go with you?" he asked. Allan's face brightened for the first time. "You dear good fellow," he exclaimed. "It was the very thing I was going to beg of you myself." Midwinter beckoned to the steward. "Mr. Armadale is going to the sanitarium," he said, "and I mean to accompany him. Get a cab and come with us." He waited to see whether Mr. Bashwood would comply. Having been strictly ordered, when Allan did arrive, not to lose sight of him, and having in his own interest Midwinter's unexpected appearance to explain to Miss Gwilt, the steward had no choice but to comply. In sullen submission, he did as he had been told. The keys of Allan's baggage was given to the foreign traveling servant whom he had brought with him, and the man was instructed to wait his master's orders at the Terminus Hotel. In a minute more, the cab was on its way out of the station, with Midwinter and Allan inside, and Mr. Bashwood by the driver on the box. Between 11 and 12 o'clock that night, Miss Gwilt, standing alone at the window which lit the corridor of the sanitarium on the second floor, heard the roll of wheels coming toward her. The sound, gathering rapidly in volume through the silence of the lonely neighborhood, stopped at the iron gates. In another minute she saw the cab draw up beneath her at the house door. The earlier night had been cloudy, but the sky was clearing now and the moon was out. She opened the window to see and hear more clearly. By the light of the moon she saw Allan get out of the cab and turn round to speak to some other person inside. The answering voice told her, before he appeared in his turn, that Armadale's companion was her husband. The same petrifying influence that had fallen on her at the interview with him of the previous day fell on her now. She stood by the window, white and still and haggard and old, as she had stood when she first faced him in her widow's weeds. Mr. Bashwood, stealing up alone to the second floor to make his report, knew the instant he set eyes on her that the report was needless. "It's not my fault," was all he said, as she slowly turned her head and looked at him. They met together, and there was no parting them. She drew a long breath and motioned him to be silent. "Wait a little," she said. "I know all about it." Turning from him at those words, she slowly paced the corridor to its furthest end, turned, and slowly came back to him with frowning brow and drooping head, with all the grace and beauty gone from her, but the inbred grace and beauty in the movement of her limbs. End of Book the Last, Chapter 3, Part 2. Book the Last, Chapter 3, Part 3 of Armadale. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Julie Bynum. Armadale by Wilkie Collins. Chapter 3, Part 3. "Do you wish to speak to me?" she asked, her mind far away from him, and her eyes looking at him vacantly as she put the question. He roused his courage as he had never roused it in her presence yet. "Don't drive me to despair," he cried with a startling abruptness. "Don't look at me in that way, now I have found it out." "What have you found out?" she asked, with a momentary surprise on her face, which faded from it again before he could gather breath enough to go on. "Mr. Armadale is not the man who took you away from me," he answered. "Mr. Midwinter is the man." "I found it out in your face yesterday. I see it in your face now. Why did you sign your name Armadale when you wrote to me? Why do you call yourself Mrs. Armadale still?" He spoke those bold words at long intervals, with an effort to resist her influence over him, pitiable and terrible to see. She looked at him for the first time with softened eyes. "I wish I had pitied you when we first met," she said gently, "as I pity you now."
He struggled desperately to go on and say the words to her which he had strung himself to the pitch of saying on the drive from the terminus. They were words which hinted darkly at his knowledge of her past life, words which warned her, do what else she might, commit what crimes she pleased, to think twice before she deceived and deserted him again. In those terms he had vowed to himself to address her. He had the phrases picked and chosen. He had the sentences ranged and ordered in his mind. Nothing was wanting but to make the one crowning effort of speaking them. And even now, after all he had said and all he had dared, the effort was more than he could compass. In helpless gratitude, even for so little as her pity, he stood looking at her and wept the silent, womanish tears that fall from old men's eyes. She took his hand and spoke to him, with marked forbearance, but without the slightest sign of emotion on her side. "You have waited already at my request," she said. "Wait till tomorrow, and you will know all. If you trust nothing else that I have told you, you may trust what I tell you now. It will end tonight." As she said the words, the doctor's step was heard on the stairs. Mr. Bashwood drew back from her, with his heart beating fast in unutterable expectation. "It will end tonight," he repeated to himself under his breath, as he moved away toward the far end of the corridor.
"Don't let me disturb you, sir," said the doctor cheerfully as they met. "I have nothing to say to Mrs. Armadale but what you or anybody may hear."
Mr. Bashwood went on, without answering, to the far end of the corridor, still repeating to himself, "It will end tonight." The doctor, passing him in the opposite direction, joined Miss Gwilt.
"You have heard, no doubt," he began in his blandest manner and his roundest tones, "that Mr. Armadale has arrived. Permit me to add, my dear lady, that there is not the least reason for any nervous agitation on your part. He has been carefully humored, and he is as quiet and manageable as his best friends could wish. I have informed him that it is impossible to allow him an interview with the young lady tonight, but that he may count on seeing her, with proper precautions, at the earliest propitious hour after she is awake tomorrow morning. As there is no hotel near, and as the propitious hour may occur at a moment's notice, it was clearly incumbent on me, under the peculiar circumstances, to offer him the hospitality of the sanitarium. He has accepted it with the utmost gratitude, and has thanked me in a most gentlemanly and touching manner for the pains I have taken to set his mind at ease.
Perfectly gratifying, perfectly satisfactory so far. But there has been a little hitch, now happily got over, which I think it right to mention to you before we all retire for the night."
Having paved the way in those words, and in Mr. Bashwood's hearing, for the statement which he had previously announced his intention of making in the event of Allan's dying in the sanitarium, the doctor was about to proceed, when his attention was attracted by a sound below like the trying of a door. He instantly descended the stairs and unlocked the door of communication between the first and second floors, which he had locked behind him on his way up. But the person who had tried the door, if such a person there really had been, was too quick for him. He looked along the corridor and over the staircase into the hall, and discovering nothing, returned to Miss Gwilt, after securing the door of communication behind him once more. "Pardon me," he resumed, "I thought I heard something downstairs. With regard to the little hitch that I adverted to just now, permit me to inform you that Mr. Armadale has brought a friend here with him, who bears the strange name of Midwinter. Do you know the gentleman at all?" asked the doctor, with a suspicious anxiety in his eyes, which strangely belied the elaborate indifference of his tone. "I know him to be an old friend of Mr. Armadale," she said. "Does he—" Her voice failed her, and her eyes fell before the doctor's steady scrutiny. She mastered the momentary weakness and finished her question. "Does he, too, stay here tonight?" "Mr. Midwinter is a person of coarse manners and suspicious temper," rejoined the doctor, steadily watching her. "He was rude enough to insist on staying here as soon as Mr. Armadale had accepted my invitation." He paused to note the effect of those words on her. Left utterly in the dark by the caution with which she had avoided mentioning her husband's assumed name to him at their first interview, the doctor's distrust of her was necessarily of the vaguest kind. He had heard her voice fail her, he had seen her color change. He suspected her of a mental reservation on the subject of Midwinter, and of nothing more.
"Did you permit him to have his way?" she asked. "In your place, I should have shown him the door." The impenetrable composure of her tone warned the doctor that her self-command was not to be further shaken that night. He resumed the character of Mrs. Armadale's medical referee on the subject of Mr. Armadale's mental health. "If I had only had my own feelings to consult," he said, "I don't disguise from you that I should, as you say, have shown Mr. Midwinter the door. But on appealing to Mr. Armadale, I found he was himself anxious not to be parted from his friend. Under those circumstances, but one alternative was left, the alternative of humoring him again." "The responsibility of thwarting him, to say nothing," added the doctor, drifting for a moment toward the truth, "of my natural apprehension, with such a temper as his friend's, of a scandal and disturbance in the house, was not to be thought of for a moment. Mr. Midwinter accordingly remains here for the night, and occupies, I ought to say insists on occupying, the next room to Mr. Armadale. Advise me, my dear madam, in this emergency," concluded the doctor with his loudest emphasis, "what room shall we put them in on the first floor?" "Put Mr. Armadale in number 4. And his friend next to him in number 3? Said the doctor. "Well, well, well, perhaps they are the most comfortable rooms. I'll give my orders immediately. Don't hurry away, Mr. Bashwood," he called out cheerfully as he reached the top of the staircase. "I have left the assistant physician's key on the windowsill yonder, and Mrs. Armadale can let you out at the staircase door whenever she pleases. Don't sit up late, Mrs. Armadale. Yours is a nervous system that requires plenty of sleep. Tired nature's sweet restorer, balmy sleep. Grand line. God bless you. Good night." Mr. Bashwood came back from the far end of the corridor, still pondering in unutterable expectation on what was to come with the night. "Am I to go now?" he asked. "No, you are to stay. I said you should know all if you waited till morning. Wait here." He hesitated and looked about him. "The doctor," he faltered. "I thought the doctor said..." "The doctor will interfere with nothing that I do in this house tonight. I tell you to stay. There are empty rooms on the floor above this. Take one of them." Mr. Bashwood felt the trembling fit coming on him again as he looked at her. "May I ask?" he began. "Ask nothing. I want you." "Will you please to tell me?" "I will tell you nothing till the night is over and the morning has come." His curiosity conquered his fear. He persisted. "Is it something dreadful?" he whispered. "Too dreadful to tell me?" She stamped her foot with a sudden outbreak of impatience. "Go," she said, snatching the key of the staircase door from the windowsill. "You do quite right to distrust me. You do quite right to follow me no further in the dark. Go before the house is shut up. I can do without you." She led the way to the stairs with the key in one hand and the candle in the other. Mr. Bashwood followed her in silence. No one, knowing what he knew of her earlier life, could have failed to perceive that she was a woman driven to the last extremity and standing consciously on the brink of a crime. In the first terror of the discovery, he broke free from the hold she had on him. He thought and acted like a man who had a will of his own again. She put the key in the door and turned to him before she opened it, with the light of the candle on her face. "Forget me and forgive me," she said. "We meet no more." She opened the door, and standing inside it, after he had passed her, gave him her hand. He had resisted her look, he had resisted her words, but the magnetic fascination of her touch conquered him at the final moment. "I can't leave you," he said, holding helplessly by the hand she had given him. "What must I do?" "Come and see," she answered, without allowing him an instant to reflect. Closing her hand firmly on his, she led him along the first floor corridor to the room numbered 4. "Notice that room," she whispered. After a look over the stairs to see that they were alone, she retraced her steps with him to the opposite extremity of the corridor. Here, facing the window which lit the place at the other end, was one little room with a narrow grating in the higher part of the door, intended for the sleeping apartment of the doctor's deputy. From the position of this room, the grating commanded a view of the bedchambers down each side of the corridor, and so enabled the deputy physician to inform himself of any irregular proceedings on the part of the patients under his care, with little or no chance of being detected in watching them. Miss Gwilt opened the door and led the way into the empty room. "Wait here," she said, "while I go back upstairs, and lock yourself in if you like. You will be in the dark, but the gas will be burning in the corridor. Keep at the grating, and make sure that Mr. Armadale goes into the room I have just pointed out to you, and that he doesn't leave it afterward. If you lose sight of the room for a single moment before I come back, you will repent it to the end of your life. If you do as I tell you, you shall see me tomorrow and claim your own reward. Quick with your answer. Is it yes or no?" He could make no reply in words. He raised her hand to his lips and kissed it rapturously. She left him in the room. From his place at the grating, he saw her glide down the corridor to the staircase door. She passed through it and locked it. Then there was silence. The next sound was the sound of the women servants' voices. Two of them came up to put the sheets on the beds in number 3 and number 4. The women were in high good humor, laughing and talking to each other through the open doors of the rooms. The master's customers were coming in at last, they said, with a vengeance. The house would soon begin to look cheerful if things went on like this. After a little, the beds were got ready, and the women returned to the kitchen floor, on which the sleeping rooms of the domestic servants were all situated. Then there was silence again. The next sound was the sound of the doctor's voice. He appeared at the end of the corridor, showing Allan and Midwinter the way to their rooms. They all went together into number 4. After a little while, the doctor came out first. He waited till Midwinter joined him and pointed with a formal bow to the door of number 3. Midwinter entered the room without speaking and shut himself in. The doctor, left alone, withdrew to the staircase door and unlocked it, then waited in the corridor, whistling to himself softly under his breath. Voices pitched cautiously low became audible in a minute more in the hall. The resident dispenser and the head nurse appeared, on their way to the dormitories of the attendants at the top of the house. The man bowed silently and passed the doctor. The woman curtsied silently and followed the man. The doctor acknowledged their salutations by a courteous wave of his hand, and once more, left alone, paused a moment, still whistling softly to himself, then walked to the door of number 4 and opened the case of the fumigating apparatus fixed near it in the corner of the wall. As he lifted the lid and looked in, his whistling ceased. He took a long purple bottle out, examined it by the gaslight, put it back, and closed the case. This done, he advanced on tiptoe to the open staircase door, passed through it, and secured it on the inner side as usual. Mr. Bashwood had seen him at the apparatus. Mr. Bashwood had noticed the manner of his withdrawal through the staircase door. Again the sense of unutterable expectation throbbed at his heart. A terror that was slow and cold and deadly crept into his hands, and guided them in the dark to the key that had been left for him in the inner side of the door. He turned it in vague distrust of what might happen next, and waited. The slow minutes passed, and nothing happened. The silence was horrible. The solitude of the lonely corridor was a solitude of invisible treacheries. He began to count to keep his mind employed, to keep his own growing dread away from him. The numbers, as he whispered them, followed each other slowly up to 100. And still nothing happened. He had begun the second 100. He had got on to 20 when, without a sound to betray that he had been moving in his room, Midwinter suddenly appeared in the corridor. He stood for a moment and listened. He went to the stairs and looked over into the hall beneath. Then, for the second time that night, he tried the staircase door, and for the second time found it fast. After a moment's reflection, he tried the doors of the bedrooms on his right hand next, looked into one after the other, and saw that they were empty, then came to the door of the end room in which the steward was concealed. Here again the lock resisted him. He listened and looked up at the grating. No sound was to be heard, no light was to be seen inside. "Shall I break the door in," he said to himself, "and make sure? No, it would be giving the doctor an excuse for turning me out of the house." He moved away and looked into the two empty rooms in the row occupied by Allan and himself, then walked to the window at the staircase end of the corridor. Here the case of the fumigating apparatus attracted his attention. After trying vainly to open it, his suspicion seemed to be aroused. He searched back along the corridor and observed that no object of a similar kind appeared outside any of the other bedchambers. Again at the window, he looked again at the apparatus, and turned away from it with a gesture which plainly indicated that he had tried and failed to guess what it might be.
Baffled at all points, he still showed no sign of returning to his bedchamber. He stood at the window, with his eyes fixed on the door of Allan's room, thinking. If Mr. Bashwood, furtively watching him through the grating, could have seen him at that moment in the mind as well as in the body, Mr. Bashwood's heart might have throbbed even faster than it was throbbing now, in expectation of the next event which Midwinter's decision of the next minute was to bring forth. On what was his mind occupied as he stood alone, at the dead of night, in the strange house? His mind was occupied in drawing its disconnected impressions together, little by little, to one point. Convinced from the first that some hidden danger threatened Allan in the sanitarium, his distrust, vaguely associated thus far with the place itself, with his wife, whom he firmly believed to be now under the same roof with him, with the doctor, who was as plainly in her confidence as Mr. Bashwood himself, now narrowed its range and centered itself obstinately in Allan's room. Resigning all further effort to connect his suspicion of a conspiracy against his friend with the outrage which had the day before been offered to himself, an effort which would have led him, if he could have maintained it, to a discovery of the fraud really contemplated by his wife, his mind, clouded and confused by disturbing influences, instinctively took refuge in its impressions of facts as they had shown themselves since he had entered the house. Everything that he had noticed below stairs suggested that there was some secret purpose to be answered by getting Allan to sleep in the sanitarium. Everything that he had noticed above stairs associated the lurking place in which the danger lay hid with Allan's room. To reach this conclusion and to decide on baffling the conspiracy, whatever it might be, by taking Allan's place, was with Midwinter the work of an instant. Confronted by actual peril, the great nature of the man intuitively freed itself from the weaknesses that had beset it in happier and safer times. Not even the shadow of the old superstition rested on his mind now. No fatalist suspicion of himself disturbed the steady resolution that was in him. The one last doubt that troubled him, as he stood at the window thinking, was the doubt whether he could persuade Allan to change rooms with him, without involving himself in an explanation which might lead Allan to suspect the truth. In the minute that elapsed, while he waited with his eyes on the room, the doubt was resolved. He found the trivial yet sufficient excuse of which he was in search. Mr. Bashwood saw him rouse himself and go to the door. Mr. Bashwood heard him knock softly and whisper, "Allan, are you in bed?"
"No," answered the voice inside. "Come in."
He appeared to be on the point of entering the room when he checked himself, as if he had suddenly remembered something. "Wait a minute," he said through the door, and turning away went straight to the end room. "If there is anybody watching us in there," he said aloud, "let him watch us through this." He took out his handkerchief and stuffed it into the wires of the grating, so as to completely close the aperture. Having thus forced the spy inside, if there was one, either to betray himself by moving the handkerchief, or to remain blinded to all view of what might happen next, Midwinter presented himself in Allan's room.
"You know what poor nerves I have," he said, "and what a wretched sleeper I am at the best of times."
"I can't sleep tonight. The window in my room rattles every time the wind blows. I wish it was as fast as your window here." "My dear fellow," cried Allan, "I don't mind a rattling window. Let's change rooms."
"Nonsense. Why should you make excuses to me?
Don't I know how easily trifles upset those excitable nerves of yours? Now the doctor has quieted my mind about my poor little Neelie, I begin to feel the journey, and I'll answer for sleeping anywhere till tomorrow comes." He took up his traveling bag. "We must be quick about it," he added, pointing to his candle. "They haven't left me much candle to go to bed by." "Be very quiet," Allan said, opening the door for him. "We mustn't disturb the house at this time of night."
"Yes, yes," returned Allan in a whisper. "Good night. I hope you'll sleep as well as I shall."
Midwinter saw him into number 3 and noticed that his own candle, which he had left there, was as short as Allan's. "Good night," he said, and came out again into the corridor. He went straight to the grating and looked and listened once more. The handkerchief remained exactly as he had left it, and still there was no sound to be heard within. He returned slowly along the corridor and thought of the precautions he had taken for the last time. Was there no other way than the way he was trying now? There was none. Any openly avowed posture of defense, while the nature of the danger and the quarter from which it might come were alike unknown, would be useless in itself,
and worse than useless in the consequences which it might produce by putting the people of the house on their guard. Without a fact that could justify to other minds his distrust of what might happen with the night, incapable of shaking Allan's ready faith in the fair outside which the doctor had presented to him, the one safeguard in his friend's interest that Midwinter could set up was the safeguard of changing the rooms. The one policy he could follow, come what might of it, was the policy of waiting for events. "I can trust to one thing," he said to himself as he looked for the last time up and down the corridor. "I can trust myself to keep awake." After a glance at the clock on the wall opposite, he went into number 4. The sound of the closing door was heard, the sound of the turning lock followed it, then the dead silence fell over the house once more. Little by little, the steward's horror of the stillness and darkness overcame his dread of moving the handkerchief. He cautiously drew aside one corner of it, waited, looked, and took courage at last to draw the whole handkerchief through the wires of the grating. After first hiding it in his pocket, he thought of the consequences if it was found on him, and threw it down in a corner of the room. He trembled when he had cast it from him, as he looked at his watch and placed himself again at the grating to wait for Miss Gwilt. It was 1:45. The moon had come round from the side to the front of the sanitarium. From time to time her light gleamed on the window of the corridor when the gaps in the flying clouds let it through. The wind had risen and sung its mournful song faintly as it swept in intervals over the desert ground in front of the house. The minute hand of the clock traveled on halfway round the circle of the dial. As it touched 1:15, Miss Gwilt stepped noiselessly into the corridor. "Let yourself out," she whispered through the grating, "and follow me." She returned to the stairs by which she had just descended, pushed the door to softly after Mr. Bashwood had followed her, and led the way up to the landing of the second floor. There she put the question to him which she had not ventured to put below stairs. "Was Mr. Armadale shown into number 4?" she asked. He bowed his head without speaking. "Answer me in words. Has Mr. Armadale left the room since?" He answered, "No." "Have you never lost sight of number 4 since I left you?" He answered, "Never." Something strange in his manner, something unfamiliar in his voice, as he made that last reply, attracted her attention. She took her candle from a table near, on which she had left it, and threw its light on him. His eyes were staring, his teeth chattered. There was everything to portray him to her as a terrified man. There was nothing to tell her that the terror was caused by his consciousness of deceiving her for the first time in his life to her face. If she had threatened him less openly when she placed him on the watch, if she had spoken less unreservedly of the interview which was to reward him in the morning, he might have owned the truth. As it was, his strongest fears and his dearest hopes were alike interested in telling her the fatal lie that he had now told, the fatal lie which he reiterated when she put her question for the second time. End of Chapter 3, Part 3. Book the Last, Chapter 3, Part 4 of Armadale. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Julie Bynum. Armadale by Wilkie Collins. Chapter 3, Part 4. She looked at him, deceived by the last man on earth whom she would have suspected of deception, the man whom she had deceived herself. "You seem to be overexcited," she said quietly. "The night has been too much for you. Go upstairs and rest. You will find the door of one of the rooms left open. That is the room you are to occupy. Good night." She put the candle, which she had left burning for him, on the table, and gave him her hand. He held her back by it desperately as she turned to leave him. His horror of what might happen when she was left by herself forced the words to his lips which he would have feared to speak to her at any other time. "Don't," he pleaded in a whisper. "Oh, don't go downstairs tonight." She released her hand and signed to him to take the candle. "You shall see me tomorrow," she said. "Not a word more now." Her stronger will conquered him at the last moment, as it had conquered him throughout. He took the candle and waited, following her eagerly with his eyes as she descended the stairs. The cold of the December night seemed to have found its way to her through the warmth of the house. She had put on a long, heavy black shawl, and had fastened it close over her breast.
The plaited coronet in which she wore her hair seemed to have weighed too heavily on her head. She had untwisted it and thrown it back over her shoulders. The old man looked at her flowing hair as it lay red over the black shawl, at her supple, long-fingered hand as it slid down the banisters, at the smooth, seductive grace of every movement that took her further and further away from him. "The night will go quickly," he said to himself as she passed from his view. "I shall dream of her till morning comes." She secured the staircase door after she had passed through it, listened, and satisfied herself that nothing was stirring, then went on slowly along the corridor to the window. Leaning on the window-sill, she looked out at the night. The clouds were over the moon at that moment. Nothing was to be seen through the darkness but the scattered gaslights in the suburb. Turning from the window, she looked at the clock. It was 20 minutes past one. For the last time, the resolution that had come to her in the earlier night, with the knowledge that her husband was in the house, forced itself uppermost in her mind. For the last time, the voice within her said, "Think, if there is no other way." She pondered over it till the minute hand of the clock pointed to the half hour. "No," she said, still thinking of her husband, "the one chance left is to go through with it to the end. He will leave the thing undone which he has come here to do. He will leave the words unspoken which he has come here to say. When he knows that the act may make me a public scandal and the words may send me to the scaffold." Her color rose, and she smiled with terrible irony as she looked up for the first time at the door of the room. "I shall be your widow," she said, "in half an hour." She opened the case of the apparatus and took the purple flask in her hand. After marking the time by a glance at the clock, she dropped into the glass funnel the first of six separate pourings that were measured for her by the paper slips. When she had put the flask back, she listened at the mouth of the funnel. Not a sound reached her ear. The deadly process did its work in the silence of death itself. When she rose and looked up, the moon was shining in at the window, and the moaning wind was quiet. Oh, the time! The time! If it could only have begun and ended with the first pouring! She went downstairs into the hall. She walked to and fro, and listened at the open door that led to the kitchen stairs. She came up again. She went down again. The first of the intervals of 5 minutes was endless. The time stood still. The suspense was maddening. The interval passed. As she took the flask for the second time and dropped in the second pouring, the clouds floated over the moon and the night view through the window slowly darkened. The restlessness that had driven her up and down the stairs and backward and forward in the hall left her as suddenly as it had come. She waited through the second interval, leaning on the window-sill and staring, without conscious thought of any kind, into the black night. The howling of a belated dog was borne toward her on the wind at intervals from some distant part of the suburb. She found herself following the faint sound as it died away into silence with a dull attention, and listening for its coming again with an expectation that was duller still. Her arms lay like lead on the window-sill. Her forehead rested against the glass without feeling the cold. It was not till the moon struggled out again that she was startled into sudden self-remembrance. She turned quickly and looked at the clock. 7 minutes had passed since the second pouring. As she snatched up the flask and fed the funnel for the third time, the full consciousness of her position came back to her. The fever heat throbbed again in her blood and flushed fiercely in her cheeks. Swift, smooth, and noiseless, she paced from end to end of the corridor, with her arms folded in her shawl, and her eye, moment after moment, on the clock. 3 out of the next 5 minutes passed, and again the suspense began to madden her. The space in the corridor grew too confined for the illimitable restlessness that had possessed her limbs. She went down into the hall again, and circled round and round it like a wild creature in a cage. At the third turn she felt something moving softly against her dress. The house cat had come up through the open kitchen door, a large, tawny, companionable cat that purred in high good temper and followed her for company. She took the animal up in her arms. It rubbed its sleek head luxuriously against her chin as she bent her face over it. "Armadale hates cats," she whispered in the creature's ear. "Come up and see Armadale killed." The next moment her own frightful fancy horrified her. She dropped the cat with a shudder. She drove it below again with threatening hands. For a moment after she stood still, then in headlong haste suddenly mounted the stairs. Her husband had forced his way back again into her thoughts. Her husband threatened her with a danger which had never entered her mind till now. What if he were not asleep? What if he came out upon her and found her with the purple flask in her hand? She stole to the door of number 3 and listened. The slow, regular breathing of a sleeping man was just audible. After waiting a moment to let the feeling of relief quiet her, she took a step toward number 4 and checked herself. It was needless to listen at that door. The doctor had told her that sleep came first, as certainly as death afterward, in the poisoned air. She looked aside at the clock. The time had come for the fourth pouring. Her hand began to tremble violently as she fed the funnel for the fourth time. The fear of her husband was back again in her heart. What if some noise disturbed him before the sixth pouring? What if he awoke on a sudden, as she had often seen him wake, without any noise at all? She looked up and down the corridor. The end room in which Mr. Bashwood had been concealed offered itself to her as a place of refuge. "I might go in there," she thought. "Has he left the key?" She opened the door to look and saw the handkerchief thrown down on the floor. Was it Mr. Bashwood's handkerchief left there by accident? She examined it at the corners. In the second corner she found her husband's name. Her first impulse hurried her to the staircase to rouse the steward and insist on an explanation. The next moment she remembered the purple flask and the danger of leaving the corridor. She turned and looked at the door of number 3. Her husband, on the evidence of the handkerchief, had unquestionably been out of his room, and Mr. Bashwood had not told her. Was he in his room now? In the violence of her agitation, as the question passed through her mind, she forgot the discovery which she had herself made not a minute before. Again she listened at the door. Again she heard the slow, regular breathing of the sleeping man. The first time the evidence of her ears had been enough to quiet her. This time, in the tenfold aggravation of her suspicion and her alarm, she was determined to have the evidence of her eyes as well. "All the doors open softly in this house," she said to herself. "There's no fear of my waking him." Noiselessly, by an inch at a time, she opened the unlocked door and looked in the moment the aperture was wide enough. In the little light she had let into the room, the sleeper's head was just visible on the pillow. Was it quite as dark against the white pillow as her husband's head looked when he was in bed? Was the breathing as light as her husband's breathing when he was asleep? She opened the door more widely and looked in by the clearer light. There lay the man whose life she had attempted for the third time, peacefully sleeping in the room that had been given to her husband and in the air that could harm nobody. The inevitable conclusion overwhelmed her on the instant. With a frantic upward action of her hands, she staggered back into the passage. The door of Allan's room fell to, but not noisily enough to wake him. She turned as she heard it close. For one moment she stood staring at it like a woman stupefied. The next, her instinct rushed into action before her reason recovered itself. In two steps she was at the door of number 4. The door was locked. She felt over the wall with both hands, wildly and clumsily, for the button which she had seen the doctor press when he was showing the room to the visitors. Twice she missed it. The third time her eyes helped her hands. She found the button and pressed on it. The mortise of the lock inside fell back, and the door yielded to her. Without an instant's hesitation she entered the room. Though the door was open, though so short a time had elapsed since the fourth pouring that but little more than half the contemplated volume of gas had been produced as yet, the poisoned air seized her, like the grasp of a hand at her throat, like the twisting of a wire round her head. She found him on the floor at the foot of the bed. His head and one arm were toward the door, as if he had risen under the first feeling of drowsiness and had sunk in the effort to leave the room. With the desperate concentration of strength of which women are capable in emergencies, she lifted him and dragged him out into the corridor. Her brain reeled as she laid him down and crawled back on her knees to the room to shut out the poisoned air from pursuing them into the passage.
After closing the door, she waited, without daring to look at him the while, for strength enough to rise and get to the window over the stairs. When the window was opened, when the keen air of the early winter morning blew steadily in, she ventured back to him and raised his head and looked for the first time closely at his face. Was it death that spread the livid pallor over his forehead and his cheeks, and the dull leaden hue on his eyelids and his lips? She loosened his cravat and opened his waistcoat and bared his throat and breast to the air. With her hand on his heart, with her bosom supporting his head, so that he fronted the window, she waited the event. A time passed, a short time enough to be reckoned by minutes on the clock, and yet long enough to take her memory back over all her married life with him, long enough to mature the resolution that now rose in her mind as the one result that would come of the retrospect. As her eyes rested on him, a strange composure settled slowly on her face. She bore the look of a woman who was equally resigned to welcome the chance of his recovery, or to accept the certainty of his death. Not a cry or a tear had escaped her yet. Not a cry or a tear escaped her when the interval had passed, and she felt the first faint fluttering of his heart, and she heard the first faint catching of the breath of his lips. She silently bent over him and kissed his forehead. When she looked up again, the hard despair had melted from her face. There was something softly radiant in her eyes, which lit her whole countenance as with an inner light and made her womanly and lovely once more. She laid him down, and taking off her shawl, made a pillow of it to support his head. "It might have been hard, love," she said, as she felt the faint pulsation strengthening at his heart. "You have made it easy now." She rose, and turning from him, noticed the purple flask in the place where she had left it since the fourth pouring. "Ah," she thought quietly, "I had forgotten my best friend. I had forgotten that there is more to pour in yet." With a steady hand, with a calm, attentive face, she fed the funnel for the fifth time. 5 minutes more," she said, when she had put the flask back after a look at the clock. She fell into thought. Thought that only deepened the grave and gentle composure of her face. "Shall I write him a farewell word?" she asked herself. "Shall I tell him the truth before I leave him forever?" Her little gold pencil case hung with the other toys at her watch chain. After looking about her for a moment, she knelt over her husband and put her hand into the breast pocket of his coat. His pocketbook was there. Some papers fell from it as she unfastened the clasp. One of them was the letter which had come to him from Mr. Brock's deathbed. She turned over the two sheets of notepaper on which the rector had written the words that had now come true, and found the last page of the last sheet a blank. On that page she wrote her farewell words, kneeling at her husband's side. "I am worse than the worst you can think of me. You have saved Armadale by changing rooms with him tonight, and you have saved him from me. You can guess now whose widow I should have claimed to be if you had not preserved his life, and you will know what a wretch you married when you married the woman who writes these lines. Still, I had some innocent moments, and then I loved you dearly. Forget me, my darling, in the love of a better woman than I am. I might perhaps have been that better woman myself if I had not lived a miserable life before you met with me. It matters little now. The one atonement I can make for all the wrong I have done you is the atonement of my death. It is not hard for me to die. Now I know you will live. Even my wickedness has one merit. It has not prospered. I have never been a happy woman." She folded the letter again and put it into his hand to attract his attention in that way when he came to himself. As she gently closed his fingers on the paper and looked up, the last minute of the last interval faced her, recorded on the clock. She bent over him and gave him her farewell kiss. "Live, my angel, live," she murmured tenderly, with her lips just touching his. "All your life is before you, a happy life, and an honored life, if you are free from me." With a last lingering tenderness she parted the hair back from his forehead. "It is no merit to have loved you," she said. "You are one of the men whom women all like." She sighed and left him. It was her last weakness.
She bent her head affirmatively to the clock, as if it had been a living creature speaking to her, and fed the funnel for the last time, to the last drop left in the flask. The waning moon shone in faintly at the window. With her hand on the door of the room, she turned and looked at the light that was slowly fading out of the murky sky. "O God, forgive me," she said. "O Christ, bear witness that I have suffered." One moment more she lingered on the threshold, lingered for her last look in this world, and turned that look on him. "Goodbye," she said softly. The door of the room opened and closed on her. There was an interval of silence. Then a sound came, dull and sudden, like the sound of a fall. Then there was silence again. The hands of the clock, following their steady course, reckoned the minutes of the morning as one by one they lapsed away. It was the 10th minute since the door of the room had opened and closed, before Midwinter stirred on his pillow, and, struggling to raise himself, felt the letter in his hand. At the same moment a key was turned in the staircase door, and the doctor, looking expectantly toward the fatal room, saw the purple flask on the window-sill and the prostrate man trying to raise himself from the floor. End of Book the Last, Chapter 3.
Epilogue, Chapter 1 of Armadale. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Michael Anthony Petronic. 1. News from Norfolk. From Mr. Pedgift Sr., Thorpe Ambrose, to Mr. Pedgift Jr., Paris. High Street, December 20th. My dear Augustus, your letter reached me yesterday. You seem to be making the most of your youth, as you call it, with a vengeance. Well, enjoy your holiday. I made the most of my youth when I was your age, and, wonderful to relate, I haven't forgotten it yet. You asked me for a good budget of news, and especially for more information about that mysterious business at the sanitarium. Curiosity, my boy, is a quality which, in our profession especially, sometimes leads to great results. I doubt, however, if you will find it leading to much on this occasion. All I know of the mystery of the sanitarium I know from Mr. Armadale, and he is entirely in the dark on more than one point of importance. I have already told you how they were entrapped into the house, and how they passed the night there. To this I can now add that something did certainly happen to Mr. Midwinter, which deprived him of consciousness, and that the doctor, who appears to have been mixed up in the matter, carried things with a high hand, and insisted on taking his own course in his own sanitarium. There is not the least doubt that the miserable woman, however she might have come by her death, was found dead, that a coroner's inquest inquired into the circumstances, that evidence showed her to have entered the house as a patient, and that the medical investigation ended in discovering she had died of apoplexy. My idea is that Mr. Midwinter had a motive of his own for not coming forward with the evidence that he might have given. I have also reason to suspect that Mr. Armadale, out of regard for him, followed his lead, and that the verdict at the inquest, attaching no blame to anybody, proceeded, like many other verdicts of the same kind, from an entirely superficial investigation of the circumstances. The key to the whole mystery is to be found, I firmly believe, in that wretched woman's attempt to personate the character of Mr. Armadale's widow when the news of his death appeared in the papers. But what first set her on this, and by what inconceivable process of deception she can have induced Mr. Midwinter to marry her, as the certificate proves, under Mr. Armadale's name, is more than Mr. Armadale himself knows. The point was not touched at the inquest, for the simple reason that the inquest only concerned itself with the circumstances attending her death. Mr. Armadale, at his friend's request, saw Miss Blanchard, and induced her to silence old Dark on the subject of the claim that had been made relating to the widow's income. As the claim had never been admitted, even our stiff-necked brother practitioner consented for once to do as he was asked. The doctor's statement that his patient was the widow of a gentleman named Armadale was accordingly left unchallenged, and so the matter has been hushed up. She is buried in the great cemetery near the place where she died, Nobody but Mr. Midwinter and Mr. Armadale, who insisted on going with him, followed her to the grave, and nothing has been inscribed on the tombstone but the initial letter of her Christian name and the date of her death. So, after all the harm she has done, she rests at last, and so the two men whom she has injured have forgiven her. Is there more to say on this subject before we leave it? On referring to your letter, I find you have raised one other point, which may be worth a moment's notice. You ask if there is reason to suppose that the doctor comes out of the matter with hands which are really as clean as they look. My dear Augustus, I believe the doctor to have been at the bottom of more of this mischief than we shall ever find out, and to have profited by the self-imposed silence of Mr. Midwinter and Mr. Armadale, as rogues perpetually profit by the misfortunes and necessities of honest men. It is an ascertained fact that he connived the false statement about Miss Milroy, which entrapped the two gentlemen into his house, and that one circumstance, after my Old Bailey experience, is enough for me. As to evidence against him, there is not a jot. And as to retribution overtaking him, I can only say I heartily hope retribution may prove, in the long run, to be the more cunning customer of the two. There is not much prospect of it at present. The doctor's friends and admirers are, I understand, about to present him with a testimonial expressive of their sympathy under the sad occurrence which has thrown a cloud over the opening of his sanitarium, and of their undiminished confidence in his integrity and ability as a medical man. We live, Augustus, in an age eminently favorable to the growth of all roguery, which is careful enough to keep up appearances. In this enlightened 19th century, I look upon the doctor as one of our rising men. To turn now to pleasanter subjects than sanitariums, I may tell you that Miss Neelie is as good as well again, and is, in my humble opinion, prettier than ever. She is staying in London under the care of a female relative, and Mr. Armadale satisfies her of the fact of his existence, in case she should forget it, regularly every day. They are to be married in the spring, unless Miss Milroy's death causes the ceremony to be postponed. The medical men are of opinion that the poor lady is sinking at last. It may be a question of weeks or a question of months. They can say no more. She is greatly altered, quiet and gentle, and anxiously affectionate with her husband and her child. But in her case, this happy change is, it seems, a sign of approaching disillusion from the medical point of view. There is a difficulty in making the poor old major understand this. He only sees that she has gone back to the likeness of her better self when he first married her, and he sits for hours by her bedside now and tells her about his wonderful clock. Mr. Midwinter, of whom you will next expect me to say something, is improving rapidly. After causing some anxiety at first to the medical men, who declared that he was suffering from a serious nervous shock, produced by circumstances about which their patient's obstinate silence kept them quite in the dark, he has rallied, as only men of his sensitive temperament, to quote the doctors again, can rally. He and Mr. Armadale are together in a quiet lodging. I saw him last week when I was in London. His face showed signs of wear and tear, very sad to see in so young a man. But he spoke of himself and his future with a courage and hopefulness which men of twice his years, if he has suffered as I suspect him to have suffered, might have envied. If I know anything about humanity, this is no common man, and we shall hear of him yet in no common way. You will wonder how I came to be in London. I went up, with a return ticket, from Saturday to Monday, about that matter in dispute at our agent's. We had a tough fight, but, curiously enough, a point occurred to me just as I got up to go, and I went back to my chair and settled the question in no time. Of course, I stayed at our hotel in Covent Garden. William, the waiter, asked after you with an affection of a father, and Matilda, the chambermaid, said you almost persuaded her that last time to have that hollow tooth taken out of her lower jaw. I had the agent's second son, the younger chap you nicknamed Mustafa, when he made that dreadful mess about the Turkish securities, to dine with me on Sunday. A little incident happened in the evening which may be worth recording, as it connected itself with a certain old lady who was not at home when you and Mr. Armadale blundered on that house in Pimlico in the bygone time. Mustafa was like all the rest of young men of the present day. He got restless after dinner. "Let's go to a public amusement, Mr. Pedgift," says he. "Public amusement? Why, it's Sunday evening," says I. "All right, sir," says Mustafa. "They stop acting on stage, I grant you, on Sunday evening. But they don't stop acting in the pulpit. Come and see the latest new Sunday performer of our time. As he wouldn't have any more wine, there was nothing else left but to go. We went to a street at the west end and found it blocked up with carriages. If it hadn't been Sunday night, I should have thought we were going to the opera. "What did I tell you?" says Mustafa, taking me up to an open door with a gas star outside and a bill of the performance. I had just time to notice that I was going to one of a series of Sunday evening discourses on the pomps and vanities of the world by a sinner who has served them, when Mustafa jogged my elbow and whispered, "Half a crown is a fashionable tip." I found myself between two demure and silent gentlemen with plates in their hands, uncommonly well filled already with the fashionable tip. Mustafa patronized one plate and I the other. We passed through two doors into a long room, crammed with people, and there, on a platform at the further end, holding forth to the audience, was not a man, as I had expected, but a woman, and that woman, Mother Oldershaw. You never listened to anything more eloquent in your life. As long as I heard her, she was never once at a loss for a word anywhere. I shall think less of oratory as a human accomplishment for the rest of my days after that Sunday evening. As for the matter of the sermon, I may describe it as a narrative of Mrs. Oldershaw's experience among dilapidated women, profusely illustrated in the pious and penitential style. You will ask what sort of audience it was. Principally women, Augustus, and, as I hope to be saved, all the old harridans of the world of fashion whom Mother Oldershaw had enameled her in her time, sitting boldly in the front places, with their cheeks ruddled with paint, in a state of devout enjoyment wonderful to see. I left Mustafa to hear the end of it, and I thought to myself, as I went out, of what Shakespeare says somewhere, "Lord, what fools we mortals be!" Have I anything more to tell you before I leave off? Only one thing that I can remember. That wretched old Bashwood has confirmed the fears I told you I had about him when he was brought back here from London. There is no kind of doubt that he has really lost all the little reason he ever had. He is perfectly harmless and perfectly happy, and he would do very well if we could only prevent him from going out in his latest new suit of clothes, smirking and smiling and inviting everybody to his approaching marriage with the handsomest of women in England. It ends, of course, in the boys pelting him, and in his coming over here crying to me, covered with mud. The moment his clothes are cleaned again, he falls back into his favorite delusion and struts about before the church gates in the character of a bridegroom waiting for Miss Gwilt. We must get the poor wretch taken care of somewhere for the rest of the little time he has to live. Who would ever have thought of a man at his age falling in love? And who would ever have believed that the mischief that woman's beauty has done could have reached as far in the downward direction as our superannuated old clerk? Goodbye for the present, my dear boy. If you see a particularly handsome snuff-box in Paris, remember, though your father scorns testimonials, he doesn't object to receive a present from his son. Yours affectionately, A. Pedgift Sr. Postscript. I think it likely that the account you mention in the French papers of a fatal quarrel among some foreign sailors in one of the Lipari Islands, and of the death of their captain, among others, may really have been a quarrel among the scoundrels who robbed Mr. Armadale and scuttled his yacht. Those fellows, luckily for society, can't always keep up appearances, and in their case, rogues and retribution do occasionally come into collision with each other. End of Epilogue, Chapter 1. Recording by Michael Anthony Petronic. www.voiceoftemptation.biz.
Epilogue, Chapter 2 of Armadale. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Bridget. Armadale, by Wilkie Collins. Epilogue, Chapter 2. Midwinter. The spring had advanced to the end of April. It was the eve of Allan's wedding day. Midwinter and he had sat talking together at the great house till far into the night, till so far that it had struck 12 long since, and the wedding day was already some hours old. For the most part, the conversation had turned on the bridegroom's plans and projects. It was not till the two friends rose to go to rest that Allan insisted on making Midwinter speak of himself. "'We have had enough, and more than enough, of my future,' he began, in his bluntly straightforward way. "'Let's say something now, Midwinter, about yours. "'You have promised me, I know, that if you take to literature, it shan't part us, "'and that, if you go on a sea voyage, you will remember, when you come back, "'that my house is your home. "'But this is the last chance we have of being together in our old way, "'and I own I should like to know.' His voice faltered, and his eyes moistened a little. He left the sentence unfinished. Midwinter took his hand and helped him, as he had often helped him to the words that he wanted in the bygone time. "'You would like to know, Allan,' he said, "'that I shall not bring an aching heart with me to your wedding day. If you will let me go back for a moment to the past, I think I can satisfy you.' They took their chairs again. Allan saw that Midwinter was moved. "'Why distress yourself?' he asked kindly. "'Why go back to the past?' "'For two reasons, Allan. "'I ought to have thanked you long since for the silence you have observed, for my sake, on a matter that must have seemed very strange to you. You know what the name is which appears on the register of my marriage, and yet you have forborne to speak of it, from the fear of distressing me. Before you enter on your new life, let us come to a first and last understanding about this. I ask you, as one more kindness to me, to accept my assurance, strange as a thing may seem to you, that I am blameless in this matter, and I entreat you to believe that the reasons I have for leaving it unexplained are reasons which, if Mr. Brock was living, Mr. Brock himself would approve. In those words he kept the secret of the two names, and left the memory of Allan's mother, what he had found it, a sacred memory in the heart of her son. "'One word more,' he went on. A word which will take us, this time, from past to future. It has been said, and truly said, that out of evil may come good. Out of the horror and the misery of that night you know of has come the silencing of a doubt which once made my life miserable with groundless anxiety about you and about myself. No clouds raised by my superstition will ever come between us again. I can't honestly tell you that I am more willing now than I was when we were in the Isle of Man to take what is called the rational view of your dream, though I know what extraordinary coincidences are perpetually happening in the experience of all of us. Still, I cannot accept coincidences as explaining the fulfillment of the visions which our own eyes have seen. All I can sincerely say for myself is, what I think it will satisfy you to know, that I have learned to view the purpose of the dream with a new mind. I once believed that it was sent to rouse your distrust of the friendless man whom you had taken as a brother to your heart. I now know that it came to you as a timely warning to take him closer still. Does this help to satisfy you that I, too, am standing hopefully on the brink of a new life, and that while we live, brother, your love and mine will never be divided again?" They shook hands in silence. Allan was the first to recover himself. He answered in the few words of kindly assurance which were the best words that he could address to his friend. "'I have heard all I ever want to hear about the past,' he said, "'and I know what I most wanted to know about the future. "'Everybody says, Midwinter, you have a career before you. "'And I believe that everybody is right. "'Who knows what great things may happen before you and I are many years older?' "'Who need know?' said Midwinter calmly. "'Happen what may, God is all-merciful, God is all-wise. "'In those words your dear old friend once wrote to me, "'and that faith I can look back without murmuring at the years that are past, "'and can look on without doubting to the years that are to come.' "'He rose, and walked to the window. "'While they had been speaking together, the darkness had passed. "'The first light of the new day met him as he looked out, "'and rested tenderly on his face. "'End of chapter 2
Appendix to Armadale. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Martin Geeson. Armadale by Wilkie Collins. Appendix. Note. My readers will perceive that I have purposely left them, with reference to the dream in this story, in the position which they would occupy in the case of a dream in real life. They are free to interpret it by the natural or the supernatural theory, as the bent of their own minds may incline them. Persons disposed to take the rational view may, under these circumstances, be interested in hearing of a coincidence relating to the present story, which actually happened, and which, in the matter of extravagant improbability, sets anything of the same kind that a novelist could imagine at flat defiance. In November 1865, that is to say when 13 monthly parts of Armadale had been published, and, I may add, when more than a year and a half had elapsed since the end of my story, as it now appears, was first sketched in my notebook, a vessel lay in the Huskisson Dock at Liverpool, which was looked after by one man, who slept on board, in the capacity of shipkeeper. On a certain day in the week, this man was found dead in the deckhouse. On the next day, a second man, who had taken his place, was carried dying to the Northern Hospital. On the third day, a third shipkeeper was appointed, and was found dead in the deckhouse which had already proved fatal to the other two. The name of that ship was the Armadale, and the proceedings at the inquest proved that the three men had been all suffocated by sleeping in poisoned air. I am indebted for these particulars to the kindness of the reporters at Liverpool, who sent me their statement of the facts. The case found its way into most of the newspapers. It was noticed, to give two instances in which I can cite the dates, in the Times of November the 30th, 1865, and was more fully described in the Daily News of November the 28th in the same year. Before taking leave of Armadale, I may perhaps be allowed to mention, for the benefit of any readers who may be curious on such points, that the Norfolk Broads are here described after personal investigation of them. In this, as in other cases, I have spared no pains to instruct myself on matters of fact. Wherever the story touches on questions connected with law, medicine, or chemistry, it has been submitted before publication to the experience of professional men. The kindness of a friend supplied me with a plan of the doctor's apparatus, and I saw the chemical ingredients at work before I ventured on describing the action of them in the closing scenes of this book. End of Appendix. End of Armadale by Wilkie Collins. Recording by Martin Geeson in Haslemere, Surrey.
Legendary doesn't happen by chance. It happens because it's what BetMGM does. Sign up for BetMGM and check out all the exciting new ways you can make this pro football season unforgettable. Shoot your shot with same-game parlays. Call your plays like a pro with live betting. Or bet on a market you didn't know existed thanks to BetMGM Originals. You'll be on the edge of your seat from the very first snap, no matter what type of fan you are. Earn BetMGM rewards points on every bet. Take advantage of football offers found nowhere else, like a second chance on a first touchdown bet. And keep an eye out for rewards dropping in your account throughout the season. Never settle for the ordinary. Sign up today. BetMGM. Make it legendary.
BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. See BetMGM.com for terms. 21 plus only. Specific promotional offers are not available in Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. For New York, call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text OPENY 467-369. For Arizona, 1-800-NEXT-STEP. For Massachusetts, 1-800-327-5050. For Iowa, 1-800-BETS-OFF. For Puerto Rico, 1-800-981-0023. Subject to eligibility requirements. In partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel.